has to be a point where we have a bottom line of understanding what the end result is going to be. It is literally an open checkbook.
In the first days of the legislative session, senators push back on Medicaid expense. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the problem with cell location service for 911 calls in Alaska.
And that would be a large, large percentage of the state that we're talking about.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The rising cost of Medicaid to the state of Alaska has been the target of criticism during the first 2 days of Senate Finance Committee hearings. The state added $100 million in additional Medicaid expense for this year after the legislature passed the budget. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon criticized the extra Medicaid spending. This money was part of more than $170 million in supplemental spending added to the budget.
It's just unacceptable, and it's out of control, and I think everyone in the legislature wants to make sure that families in need have access to medical care and that we can support them where we can, but we do not have $170 million worth of extra money.
State Budget Director Pat Pitney says the costs were due to unexpectedly high Medicaid enrollment. Some was from the Medicaid expansion enacted by Governor Bill Walker. She added that the federal government is covering 90% of the cost of the expansion. Pitney says this spending helps make health care one of the only industries that's growing in the state.
Our state budget on Medicaid today is the same as it was in fiscal year 15, and we're serving over 75,000 more people have had access to health care.
Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says the administration needs to stay within the budget.
When Medicaid was expanded, it was expanded with a set of assumptions that were simply incorrect. There has to be a point where we have a bottom line of understanding what the end result is going to be. I mean, it is literally an open checkbook.
Pitney says the administration is in the middle of making changes to Medicaid that it expects will save money, and the state is also considering a new health care authority that would aim to lower the health care costs of state workers and retirees. Pitney noted Alaska has the highest health care costs in the country that has the highest health care costs in the world. She says the state doesn't have any choice but to try to keep costs down. The U.S. Senate today approved an extension of the controversial Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Both of Alaska's senators voted no. Section 702 allows the federal government to collect emails and phone records of foreigners overseas without a warrant. Proponents say it's an important anti-terrorism tool, but privacy advocates warn it could sweep up communications of Americans who are in touch with people in other countries. Senator Lisa Murkowski said in a written statement she wanted to consider amendments to ensure the law protects the privacy of Americans while pursuing national security goals. Senator Dan Sullivan's office did not respond to an emailed question about his vote. The FISA section was renewed by a Senate vote of 65 to 34. Representative Don Young voted for it in the House last week. The bill now goes to the president for his signature. More than 70% of today's calls to 911 are made through cell phones. That's according to the Alaska Department of Public Safety. But if you call 911 for help using a cell phone in Bethel, the police department won't be able to trace that call, and you need to describe exactly where you are. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports that this lapse has led to some close calls.
One night last December, DK's husband started drinking, and a few drinks in, he started to punch her.
I was thrown onto the floor a few times and into the wall.
DK grabbed her cell phone and called 911.
I just had a few minutes to dial 911 and toss my phone in the closet. You know, I was hoping they could hear me screaming for help.
She fought her husband and tried to put him in a chokehold. Her dad and brother had taught her how to do it. And when her husband saw she'd called the police, he ran from the house. DK says she chose to talk to KYUK to raise awareness about domestic violence, which she says is too often suffered in silence. After her husband ran, she called 911 again, and some officers came to help her. But that first time DK called 911, the police didn't show up. They can't track callers' locations and wouldn't have known where she was. Do you think you would have done anything differently if you'd known that the BPD couldn't track the call?
I probably would have tried to hide and stay on the phone.
Bethel Police Department.
Natalie Hayes is a former dispatcher for the Bethel Police Department. She's actually working as a dispatcher again, temporarily. The Bethel PD's short-staffed. She's sitting in front of two different computer screens, fielding calls from two different phone lines and a police radio.
Bravo 3 PD.
Go ahead.
Hayes says that Bethel PD has been trying to upgrade its system so that it can track callers' locations for months. And according to both her and Acting Police Chief Burke Waldron, their 911 system does have the capability to receive exact GPS coordinates from cell phones. They just updated it last summer. The problem, Hayes says, is GCI, which needs to update its own equipment for the system to work. Hayes says that they asked GCI to upgrade last summer, but GCI spokesperson Heather Handyside says the company has no record of receiving that letter, and they didn't know it was an issue. Regardless of who might have dropped the ball here, the Bethel Police Department is still in a situation where it can only get a general sense of where cell phone callers actually are. To demonstrate just how big a problem this can be, Hayes asks me to take out my cell phone.
Okay, so you're calling 911, and as you can see, all I have is your no record found and your phone number.
Not my location, and I'm sitting right next to her.
I can call you back, but if you don't answer or because something's happening to you, there's nothing I can do.
Bethel is far from the only community in Alaska that's having this problem, even though the technology exists to solve it. According to the Alaska Department of Public Safety's John Rockwell, 911 systems in a lot of Alaskan communities don't have cell phone location services, and that includes towns on the road system.
And that would be a large, large percentage of the state that we're talking about.
Through the course of KYUK's reporting on this issue, GCI got in touch with the Bethel Police Department. Spokesperson Heather Handyside says they're assessing whether the department's system was properly updated and will then upgrade their own technology, a process that could take months. Until it's fixed, Bethel Police Dispatcher Natalie Hayes has some advice. Tell your 911 dispatcher exactly where you are.
I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists are getting better at pinning unusual weather events on climate change.
We've generally demurred, but now we have enough data, we have enough computing power to say, aha.
That's it. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
An Alaska prison remains on lockdown following a disturbance that the Department of Corrections is calling a riot. Spokeswoman Megan Edge says 43 inmates were involved and five were treated for injuries following the disturbance on Wednesday at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward. Shortly after 1 p.m., corrections officers saw inmates fighting in the prison yard. Edge says officers followed prison protocol by ordering inmates to lie on the ground and administered pepper spray. Corrections officers regained control in 2.5 minutes. She says the cause of the riot has not been determined, but officials believe it was related to gangs. All five injured inmates were returned to the prison after hospital treatment. A federal grand jury indicted two Anchorage residents on drug charges following a seizure of methamphetamine and heroin with an estimated street value of $1.2 million. U.S. Attorney Brian Schroeder today announced the indictment of 62-year-old Wilton Tony and 58-year-old Danita Love. Prosecutors say law enforcement officers on Friday seized two FedEx parcels containing 13 pounds of methamphetamine and 3 pounds of heroin. Law enforcement officers on Saturday conducted a controlled delivery of the parcels to a hotel near Anchorage's main airport and watched Tony receive the parcels. Prosecutors say he took them to his room where he was arrested with Danita Love. Officers seized more drugs, digital scales, and 3 guns. Attorneys for Tony and Love did not immediately respond to email requests for comment. After a record-setting weekend, temperatures have dropped to a more normal range in Sitka and elsewhere around Southeast. Sitka topped 60 degrees 3 times over the Martin Luther King Day weekend. Annette Island recorded a high of 65 on January 14th. Over the past couple of decades, satellites, computers, and remote data collection have made huge advances in weather forecasting possible. But now the National Weather Service is bringing online one of the most sophisticated weather observation tools ever, regular people. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Of course, it's an app. You can download it for your Android or your smartphone from the App Store.
This app was actually initially developed to kind of help calibrate radars.
David Levin is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Juneau. He says the technology was developed in 2012 at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Oklahoma.
When we first came out with this, what's called dual-pole radar technology, it allows you to see the shape and the type of precip as opposed to just how much precip is out there. But they weren't sure how it was actually doing, so they developed this app where people could kind of tell you what the precip was occurring at their location, and then they could look on the radar and see what the radar was indicating was happening. They could calibrate those precip types that way.
And so MPING was born. It stands for Meteorological Phenomena Identification Near the Ground. MPING combines the global positioning capabilities of your phone, which is the technology behind Google Maps, with old-school weather observation. It's crowdsourced weather data, and Levin says it's been especially useful in the lower 48 to track the intensity of severe storms. In populated areas, the accumulating pings as people track and report weather start to resemble a kind of human radar. In Alaska, where low population density is the rule, the MPING app is serving a slightly different role.
Up here, we've actually found it useful for some of the areas where we don't have weather observation equipment. It's really kind of hard sometimes to tell what's going on in some of these more remote communities.
Levin says forecasters have real-time access to data from MPING. The pings arrive, in this case, on a big map of Southeast Alaska, and they're graphic. Snowflakes appear when someone reports snow. Raindrops appear for rain. The app has a drop-down menu of the kinds of things you can report, like drizzle or ice pellets, and it allows you to report storm damage, like uprooted trees. And Levin says you can also report nothing, as in nice weather.
Believe it or not, that's actually kind of helpful. If we have a forecast out for, heavy snow and it's not actually doing anything, that would be kind of an example where nothing would be helpful.
So whether a lot of people download and use MPING or whether just a few people use it in places where forecasters have no remote tools, the app will contribute to making better weather forecasts. If I were a betting man, I'd say MPING is going to catch on. People like talking about the weather. Now they can ping it right to a screen in front of the weather guy himself. Well, thanks a lot for your time, David. We'll get something on the air, and I'll get a link to this on our website so people can download it and start using it.
Sounds good. Yeah, I see we just got a test ping from Sitka, so that maybe that was somebody there that's
sensing our conversation.
Yeah,
is happening.
Who knows?
And so begins right. What might become the MPING flood. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In 2014, a warm water system known as the Blob wreaked havoc in the waters of the Gulf of Alaska. The relationship between extreme weather events and climate change is complicated. but scientists are getting closer to figuring out how the two are linked. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Brian Brett-Schneider, an Anchorage-based climatologist, doesn't want to utter the phrase, believe in climate change anymore. It was even one of his New Year's resolutions. Belief, he says, can be murky. It implies having faith in something you can't see.
I think accepting climate change is a much better term to use.
As in, do you accept the consensus of the scientific community that climate change is real? Still, Brett-Schneider says linking human-caused warming to extreme weather events, like rising ocean temps, hurricanes, or floods, has been a work in progress. There's been a movement in the scientific community to do more attribution studies, because they can attribute the cause of these events to climate change. But the tools weren't always there.
We've been asked this for many, many years. Is this something that's climate change? And again, we've generally demurred. But now we have enough data, we have enough computing power to say, aha.
Recently, three different papers published in the Bulletin of American Meteorology had that aha moment. They were all about extreme weather events across the globe. Brett-Schneider co-authored one of them. His study looked at the warm water anomaly known as the Blob. Named after the classic Bee horror movie, the Blob showed up in the Gulf of Alaska around 2014, lasting close to 2 years. During that time, there were massive seabird die-offs and increased reports of paralytic shellfish poisoning. Brett-Schneider says scientists knew the Blob was caused by unusual atmospheric conditions. But there was more to the story. With climate modeling, the study suggests that the Blob would not have occurred without human-induced warming.
So right now, it's an outlier in an already warmed world. In a more warmed world, it'll be a more typical condition.
Which, he says, means on the current trajectory, in 20 years or so, events like the Blob could start to become the new norm.
You know, we may end up with an ecological setting, you know, more similar to, say, the coast of California than what we are accustomed to along the coast of Alaska.
But that doesn't mean there isn't anything we can't do about it. Brett-Schneider says the business-as-usual model is just one scenario. It doesn't include reducing carbon emissions. And as more scientists focus their work on climate change attribution, he says it could be beneficial for crafting environmental policy in the future. He acknowledges the relationship between scientists and lawmakers hasn't always been smooth.
The response often has been, you know, you guys are crooked, made up, making stuff up, and, you know, trying to get so I can't drive my truck.
But he's optimistic that the people in charge will come around. He says the science community is getting better at discerning the root of extreme weather events and climate change. And the facts are hard to deny. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race is no stranger to severe weather. In nearly four decades of competing, mushers have endured everything from brutal cold and bare tundra to hard ice and heavy overflow. But this year, Bethel is experiencing its warmest winter ever. So warm that officials have had to contract the route to avoid open water, so it doubles back on itself. KYUK's Laura Craigle has more on how this year ranks in a long history of adverse weather.
Myron Angstman is chairman of the K300. He's been involved ever since he helped found the race in 1980, when a blizzard obliterated the trail and prompted an unplanned 24-hour layover while volunteers scrambled to lay new stakes.
The first year was horrendous, and there'd been many years ever since.
Angstman says those years have brought all kinds of challenging weather, from wind chill that dips 100 degrees below zero to endless glare ice that sends even the best dog teams skidding. One of his favorite stories comes from a race defined by deep overflow. Angstman was working on the trail crew when he passed two-time champion Rick Swenson, wading through feet of water and muttering angrily to himself.
He didn't look real happy, and I said, Jesus, Swenson. You do this for a living?
Angstman says that smugness only lasted about an hour until he got stuck in a different puddle just as Swenson caught up.
And he looked down at me with the same tone I had used on him and said, you do this for fun?
Despite decades of unpredictable weather, the K300 has never been canceled. Engstman says officials have postponed the race and rerouted it, but they always find a solution, something he calls key to its longevity and reputation as a premier mid-distance competition.
One of the reasons we've been here for 39 years is that we find a way to put on the race.
This winter is no different. Officials have decided to cut the trail in half and have mushers run it twice. That way, they'll avoid a scattering of open holes upriver, some so large they span from bank to bank. Engstman says the new route is just another fix in a long tradition of dealing with difficult weather, but ingenuity is bound to have its limits, and the Cusco 300 founder knows that.
If it warms up as much in the next 30 years as it has in the past 30, we could really see a disappearance of mushing in this area.
For this year at least, Engstman says he's glad they've found another way to get dog teams on the trail. The K300 starts Friday evening. In Bethel, I'm Laura Craigle.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Some tough decisions face the Alaska Board of Fisheries this week. One of those is how to conserve dwindling king salmon stocks in a way that won't financially cripple Southeast salmon fishermen. KTOO's Jacob Resnick has been following testimony in Sitka.
3 days of marathon testimony wrapped up Wednesday, with hundreds of fishermen speaking before the Board of Fisheries. The board meets regionally every 3 years to write and revise fishing rules. It holds great sway over the fortunes of the commercial fleet, fishing guides. It also affects subsistence. For groups that traditionally find little common ground, there's consensus on this. King salmon are in trouble. Here's Haines-based fisherman Lindsay Johnson.
I'm extremely concerned for the fate of the king salmon, and I'll gladly do whatever the experts prescribe to bring them back.
But how far those conservation measures go is in dispute. Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists presented a range of options, from maintaining the status quo to blanket restrictions and widespread closures. Most fishermen say they'd accept some restrictions if research suggests they're effective. Dan Gray, the Southeast supervisor in charge of king salmon, says there's a lot at stake for a lot of people.
Certainly the fishermen are concerned about their futures. And rightfully so. This is uncharted territory for king salmon.
King salmon, also known as Chinook, are valuable. Recently, they've been fetching in excess of $10 a pound for fishermen. Sitka Troll fisherman Tad Fujioka said in an interview Wednesday that closures during the prime fishing, that's March to July, would be devastating.
Almost all the fishermen are Alaska residents that time of year, many of them from small communities. The fishery is right in front of Hoona, right in front of Angoon. Sweeping big closures like that will really hurt the smaller communities.
Tourism is also at stake. Sitka charter boat captain Mike Sullivan told the board that proposals that would force non-residents to release any king salmon they catch would harm businesses across Southeast.
If the charter industry suffers, it will be hard for the fleet and this place to regain its reputation as an unparalleled fishing destination.
Each action plan focuses on a king salmon system. Most have failed to meet their escapement goals. That's having enough fish return to freshwater and spawn. Researchers don't know exactly the reason for the decline, only that it appears to be happening in the open ocean rather than state waters where Alaska's salmon fisheries are managed. The rest of the week, Gray says, will be intense back and forth between the board and select stakeholders and interest groups.
The board takes their charge very seriously here on stocks of concern, and your guess is as good as mine as to where they might go.
In Sitka, I'm Jacob Resnick.
After a few weather delays, the Tanner Crab fishery opened today at noon. It's the first time the fishery has been open in the Kodiak area since 2013. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche stopped by St. Herman Harbor on Near Island to talk with fishermen before they set off.
Hey, this one's done.
Fisherman Clint Johnson hands an empty bucket of hydraulic fuel up to his crewmate. He says they have 1,000 gallons, the max the vessel can take.
Hydraulic's like the blood of this operation. Without it, we're just dead in the water.
It tops the list the crew needs to check off in the next few hours.
A little bit of gas, bait, and go.
Johnson says it's expensive to gear up, and it's also no sure thing that the crew will earn more than it pays out.
Got to pay for everything, so got to do that at least. If we make more than that for the effort, great.
Johnson says he makes his living off salmon, and the last time he fished for Tanner crab was in the 90s. He says the vessel, the Kaywick, hasn't been rigged for crab for 30 years.
But we borrowed all the gear. Fire in the hall.
On a nearby float, the Lady Ashley is also getting ready. Jim Monroe and his crew member peer into the vessel's engine room, which is less a room and more of a nook.
Okay, let's see. You got bubbles?
They're all gone. I'm just getting straight fuel.
Two other crew members are on board, and Monroe says it wasn't hard to find people to hire for the trip.
For this little season, there's a lot of interest because nobody's been doing anything for a while. It can be kind of lucrative if you get on the prices, right?
His daughter, Darlene Monroe, is optimistic.
It's been a few years since I've done it, so I hope that we're on them. They've had a lower reporting, so I'm not expecting a whole lot, but hoping for the best.
Like the Kaywick, the Lady Ashley is about to head off. Crews started warming up their engines as soon as registration wrapped up Wednesday morning. That's according to Nat Nichols, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management Biologist for the Groundfish, Shellfish, and Dive Fisheries. Nichols says the guideline harvest level is 400,000 pounds.
In the past, that's brought out a number of participants in the mid-30s. This year, we're going to end up in the mid-50s, most likely. Some of that's probably due to the fact that cod fishing is a bit slow this year, and also just that we haven't had a fishery in 4 years, so there's a little more excitement because of that.
Fishermen call in their catches by radio, and Nichols says they'll have a better idea of how fast fishermen will reach the cap over the next few days. He says the range is probably 3 to 7 days, and March 31st is the end of the regulatory season. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Teresa Katsourilis and Laura Craigle in Bethel, Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Robert Woolsey and Jacob Resnick in Sitka, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.